All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a CW-2 warrant officer type helicopter pilot, Republic of Vietnam in 1969. We want to welcome you today to Veterans Radio. I think we've got a really fun show and an exciting program. We're going to, as all of you out there like to do, we're going to be talking about dogs for the first half of the program. And I know that you all love dog stories. And we've got a, I'm going to be talking with a young lady that's part of an organization that trains service dogs. And then I've got a young author on, who wrote a book about a service dog, and it is a fictional story, but it's a really powerful story called Rescue. His name is Christopher Dant, so I'm really anxious to talk to both of them. On the second half of the program, we're going to be talking with a crew chief from the 160th Aviation Company, or the SOAR, Special Operations. They're the ones that drop special forces, SEALs and Navy SEALs and so forth all over the world. So it's a really interesting story and factual. It's about his experiences with the 160th. And as a crew chief, door gunner, et cetera, et cetera. It's a lot more sophisticated than it was when I was a helicopter pilot, so don't miss that story. If you'd like to get in on the conversation today, you can by giving us a call here at Veterans Radio. The number is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Some of you, I hope, are listening to us on the internet. You can email me if you've got a question for our guest, dale@veteransradio.net, and we'll pick that up for you as well. Also, I want to thank our sponsors, of course, for today. That is Legal Help for Veterans here in Michigan, and that's all they do is they handle your disability claims. That's Legal Help for Veterans. Also, the Charles Kettles VVA, Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 310 here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The VFW Post 423 here in Ann Arbor, and also the American Legion Post 46 here in Ann Arbor. We really want to thank those guys and women for their support for us. If without their monetary support, we wouldn't be on the air. So I really want to thank them all very much. Well, let's get right into the program. And my first guest is actually, as a result of reading the book Rescue, that I reached out for an organization called Paws for Purple Hearts. And this is an organization that trains service dogs. And the young woman who is on the line with me right now, I hope, Lindsay, good afternoon. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, how are you doing?
I am doing fine. And I didn't want to butcher your name, so I didn't say your last name because I can't even read my own writing. So Lindsay, what is your last name?
Strzok.
Pardon? Are you there?
Yes, it's Stiefvater.
Okay. Stiefvater. I got it.
Yes.
All right. All right. So anyway, I talked with Lindsay earlier today and to learn more about Paws for Purple Hearts, and you are the public relations person for the the branch or the division that's on the East Coast?
Yes, it's for the East Coast, so we have five branches, and I'm the PR person for the Ruther Glen branch.
Okay, so tell me all about Paws for Purple Hearts. What does this organization do?
So to give you a little bit of background, our CEO, Bonnie Bergen, she actually founded the concept of the service dog to assist people with mobility limitations, and she founded that in 1975, and in 2004, she founded the University, Bergen University of Canine Study. And this is a university dedicated to teaching service dog trainers in the world. And what was a pilot program at Bergen was the canine-assisted warrior therapy. And in 2006, that's what we turned it into a nonprofit, Paws for Purple Heart.
Okay. Okay. And so tell me a little bit about your organization, because I know that we're going to get into that a little bit more with our author guest. So how is it different from the other organizations out there?
So Paws for Purple Hearts is one of the only service dog nonprofit training places for veterans. So Our main goal, or our main veterans that we tutor for, is PTSD, TBIs, MST, and mobility impairment. So we train these dogs for service dogs, and our other services that we actually have is our most popular, and it's called Canine Assisted Warrior Therapy. And that is where we teach veterans to train the dogs.
Oh, okay. So the veteran is actually training a dog at the same time training himself, it sounds like.
Yeah, so our saying is warriors helping warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those individuals, for those veterans who maybe don't qualify for a service dog or they don't feel that they need a service dog, but they need that sense of being and need that sense of accomplishment, we teach them how to train the dog, and it's for our fellow comrades.
Okay. And so you've got how many facilities around the country?
We have five. We have Menlo Park in California, San Diego in California, and we have Fairbanks in Alaska, San Antonio, mm-hmm. Texas, and then Ruthor Glen, Virginia.
And if I wanted to support Paws for Purple Hearts, why would I do that?
Well, you're supporting two different causes. You're supporting the veterans, which I believe that is, you know, America is founded on those individuals, mm-hmm. how they have laid their life down for us. And then you're also, you know, if you're an animal lover, you're supporting dogs, and you're combining the two, and you're having dogs help our service members after they've laid down their life for us.
Mm-hmm.
And you keep supporting them because that's what they need. They need us.
Right. Well, they do. We know so many people personally who have service animals, and they've made such a huge difference in their lives. I think not only for the veteran, but also for the dogs, it seems like.
Oh, yes. So dogs, they love that sense of pleasing people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have them doing work and have them training and doing therapy work, it you know, brightens up their day too, not just the veterans.
Okay, so if we want to help out at least monetarily, we can go to pawsforpurplehearts.org, correct?
Yes, and there's a donation box. Mm-hmm. You just click on that, and you can donate nationally. So go to all of our locations, or you can do individual locations.
Okay. Well, thank you, Lindsay, very much for taking time out of your day. I appreciate you participating on such short notice, and thank you very much.
No, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Okay. That's Paws for Purple Hearts, folks. That's Warriors Helping Warriors. Go to their websites, pawsforpurplehearts.org. You can donate money. You can donate your time. You could all kinds of things that you can get involved there. They got a great work site. Looks like it's pretty user-friendly, so I encourage you to do that. Listening in on the conversation right now, and I wanted to just bring him on before we talk about your book, is Christopher Dant. And Christopher, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio as well.
Thank you very much, Dale.
Well, thank you for writing this book, and it's called Rescue. And before I talk about the book, I want to get one unfortunate thing out of the way, and that is that as I was reading your acknowledgement, not only did you talk about the Paws for Purple Hearts, but you talked about a great man who was on Veterans Radio about 5 years ago or so with his dog Tuesday, and that was Luis Carlos Montalban, an Iraq
yes.
War veteran who owned Tuesday, the Golden Retriever. And as soon as I saw that, I said, I got to read the book, and then, of course, I wanted to follow up on it. And you said that you knew him.
I knew him peripherally. He mm-hmm. and I corresponded. He was out, actually, in the East Coast at one point when he was in the middle of doing his book tour and was on, mm-hmm. you know, many night shows and so forth. And we got to talking. So, and I'm a veteran as well, although I was in Vietnam and not Iraq.
That's, yeah.
So,
It's not quite the same terrain. Still is frightening, though.
No, it is not. But
and unfortunately, we lost him.
Yes. Well, that's one of the reasons that it started me thinking about this, because he committed suicide. I think that's pretty well known. He wasn't with his dog Tuesday when it happened, but mm-hmm. The dog is now with his trainer back at what they call ECAD, which is a training organization he worked with. Mm-hmm. So I thought of him. I thought of how important, his service dog Tuesday was to him. I mean, the book Until Tuesday really illustrates that beautiful relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some veterans who have service dogs, And although I've never, you know, been involved with that, it came, a story came to me about a veteran who owned a beautiful service dog. And the compelling aspect of it is was how powerful that relationship was and how it came to be in the book. But unfortunately, early on in the book, the dog is abducted. Mm-hmm. It disappears from the man's life and what he went through. And it's really a story of sacrifice and service and the courage and perseverance of a man and the love and devotion of a remarkable and unforgettable dog. So it most of it takes place in over 2 years and a thousand miles through wilderness and city streets and so forth to reunite, get the dog and man reunited. Although the reader doesn't know that, and so it has a beautiful ending. But
I don't want to get to the ending quite yet.
Yeah, I build suspense. I try to build suspense. Yeah,
but it's a great read, and I want to take a real quick break, Chris, and then come back and talk more about the
Surely.
Book, and encourage our listeners out there. If you have any questions about service dogs or you know stories that you'd like to share, please give us a call here on Veterans Radio today at 734-822-1600. We're going to take a real fast break, and then we'll be back talking about the book is Rescue by Christopher Dant. We're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with the author, Christopher Dant. His book is Rescue, about a service dog named Chauncey. And I just want to read something from the back cover of the book. And it says, Rescue is a remarkable and heartfelt story of a war veteran, Captain Dirk Hansen, who lives in his confined world of post-traumatic stress. But an extraordinary service dog, Chauncey, transforms him heart and soul. But one day his dog vanishes, forging a two-year harrowing odyssey that both man and dog must endure. Hope grows from despair in this gripping but charming story of a man and his beloved dog. Rescue illustrates the resiliency and imagination of dogs, the remarkable bond they have with the disabled, and ultimately the greatness that all dogs bring to our lives. I think that's really kind of that's a great statement there for you, Christopher.
Thank you. I wrote that.
I guess you must really like it. I'm sure, but it is. What I wanted to talk about, and you know, obviously, mm-hmm. you know, we don't want to give away the whole story because I do want people to buy it. I found it really an uplifting story, and it was one that I went back to. I got my book has got all kinds of little pages, you know, fold in the corners and all that other stuff because you just really tell a great story. I wanted to talk about the process that you went through in writing this. You know, I know that you were motivated by, you know, what you had seen and by, you know, Tuesday, but how did you delve into this and learn all that you did?
Well, again, and so I start off because I studied fiction at Stanford, and had been, you know, writing for most of my career, although not all of it has been fiction. But when writing fiction, the first law is that you must make it believable to your readers. Mm-hmm. The reader has to read it and say, wow, this is really happening. As soon as you lose the reader in the reality, saying, oh, that could never happen, or, oh, that person would never say that or do that, then you lose your reader. So I had to have this thing 100% real. So before I delved into it, I had to interview a number of veterans who have PTSD, mm-hmm. And a couple who are on the back of the book, Russ Stafford, who has his dog, a golden retriever named Major, lives in Northern California, and actually, no, he lives, I think he's in Montana, I think, and also Steve Moore, who is a veteran Army sergeant and owns a service dog group mm-hmm. called Canine Constitutional. Russ was from Paws for Purple Hearts, and I also talked with the Paws for Purple Hearts people, particularly Bonnie Bergen, that your last guest mentioned, and, you know, discussed, you know, the concept of how dogs are trained, how veterans are paired with dogs, what is that process emotionally, and then, you know, what is the actual, you know, duties that they have to go through, and how long does it take, and so forth, and get a real familiarity. And, of course, Lewis really went into that quite deeply in his book as well. So I took some from that. But I also, you know, talked to a number of psychologists who deal with veterans and say, what is this? What is PTSD? And what is it really like? What exactly do these people go through? And how do the dogs, you know, there's been a great book written by Temple Grandin about dogs and how they work with the disabled. And of course she has, autism. So I studied that, quite a bit. So I got a real strong grip on what exactly happens. So the fiction that I wrote is based on reality, and it took 2.5 years to do this. So it was quite a bit of study. And you know, discovery of what the story would look like.
Well, I think it takes, based on your story and from other people I've talked to, sometimes it takes almost 2 years to match a dog in their training to the veteran, because there has to be that particular connection that has to be made. And you know, you go into real detail, real emotional detail of actually the dog picking the veteran almost more than the veteran picking the dog.
Yes. And I have several friends who are disabled. They aren't veterans, but they do have service dogs, and they talked to me about that emotional bond. It's very, very strong. And in this particular book, I wanted to make that really particularly strong, because the dog goes into a prison program, and many of them do, and, you know, gets bonded with a prisoner for the first 6 months of its life, and then is pulled away to go back into further training before she goes, the dog would go to a veteran. So the dog, you know, initially was very wary and, you know, distrustful of anybody. And, you know, Dirk Hansen, who is my hero, who is the veteran, also, you know, was just, it was like many vets with PTSD. And the two found each other and trusted each other. Despite that, and that's what made the bond so strong, and that's why when she's abducted, it's emotionally wrenching. Any animal lover, any pet lover would say that's emotionally wrenching. If their dog goes missing, it's awful. But this in particular, but I didn't write it to have a wrenching story of lost dog, found dog. It's more the relationship between them and what they'll go through to find each other. And that was the hard part.
Oh, what I really liked and enjoyed was the bonding that Chauncey, the dog, would make with the people that passed through her life while she was on the lam, I guess you could say, you know, trying to find trying her way home. I mean, the prisoner who trained her, you know, suddenly, you know, was able to face up, to himself and realize that he had worth as well. And then even the people that took the dog were just so amazed by her behavior and you know, so forth. And people along the line.
The dog, in a sense, sort of taught a lot of people. And there was a lot of self-revealing in the book about the homeless man who finds the dog and takes her in. And other people who have her, and you know, this is all very realistic. I mean, it could have very easily happened. And you know, I studied some writing early on from a guy named Ken Burns. I know you know who he is.
Yeah, familiar with him.
and he yes. He told me, you know, it's your responsibility to lead the readers into hell, into chaos and conflict, you know, and uncertainty. But it's a place they did never expect it to be, but it's also your responsibility to lead them out and find a hopeful message. And I never forgot that, and that's really what I tried to do in this book.
Well, I think it's a great story, and I strongly encourage our people out there to buy it. It's available on Amazon. It's available everywhere, I hope. It should be.
Yes. Well, it's not available in nationwide bookstores, but it is available on Amazon. You just type my name, Christopher Dant, or, you know, rescue the novel, and you'll see it. It's a picture of a dog looking away from the camera at a house.
I know. Yeah.
Snowy field.
I wanted to ask you just a couple of quick questions about not only about the book, but you mentioned that you were in the service yourself.
Yes, I was.
You were in Vietnam. What was your MOS over there?
Well, I was in Quantico. I was the officer training OCS.
Oh, okay.
And I never got shipped over to Vietnam. I ended up, I had an injury, and they kept me over in Quantico doing some training with a recruit. So I never ended up in Vietnam, but I spent my career, my service there in Quantico.
Mm-hmm. Did you, just a quick aside, did you write any of this character based on you?
No. The character is based on nobody I knew, not even Lewis. I wanted to make it a unique character.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't on me.
You never know.
Yeah.
Kind of, certain things might sneak in there every once in a while.
But the emotion behind it was based on some things that Lewis had said. You know, just the beauty of the relationship between the dog and the man. It's really an incredible relationship.
Well, I think our audience would be really, it's kind of like a dual book. If they had one, they should read the other one. The idea of Until Tuesday, I can remember my interview with him, with Lewis, and, you know, it was just such a powerful interview, and he was so committed to each other, and that, you know, that what he had done probably would have happened a lot sooner if he had never, you know, had Tuesday in his life. And the idea of what Chauncey, you know, does for your protagonist is very similar.
Yeah. I mean, it really transforms him, and, you know, he really finds that he can't live without the dog. I mean, it is everything to him. And, you know, it's sad because, you know, a third of the vets come home back with PTSD and less than 40% of them ever seek treatment.
Right.
And, you know, there's this hopelessness and fear, that they have. And I think the solution comes with four paws and a wet nose.
That certainly is one of them. It is one of them. That's one of the things that we like to talk about on our program are all the options that people have out there. It's not only, you know, the dogs. And you bring in the trainer of Chauncey in here, which is, you know, very much like, you know, all of these different groups that are out there, the Paws for Purple Hearts and so forth, that are so devoted to their animals as well. And she gets heavily involved in the chase and all of the characters, not all of the characters, but the vast majority of the characters are trying to reunite the dog with Dan. And, I just found that to be really an interesting story. And it was not a hard read. I mean, there were some scary parts in it and some very, let's just say there are some really bad characters that come through there. Not badly written.
You had to put some bad dudes in the book. You know?
They're not badly written characters. They're just bad guys. No. That's all.
No, it's just, you know, there's a force that is against it. And it's not just a lost dog, lost found. There's some people that find this dog and get this dog and see that it's worth a lot of money and try to make some money out of it and try to take advantage of that. My writing professor at Stanford used to say, well, how did you feel about writing this? And I'd say, oh, I love this. This it was so easy to write and I loved it. And I was smiling. He says, well, then it's pure junk. He said, you know, when you write something that's going to move your reader, you're going to feel it too. And the struggles that I wrote in this book were very painful to write, difficult because they were so real, and not necessarily me because I've never lost a dog, but it just I could feel it, and I wanted to get the reader to feel it. And most of every reader that I've talked to a lot of them online, and there's some reviews online and Amazon, and they just say, thank you for writing this. It was so frightening to read. And I couldn't, I almost had to go to the ending to make sure she was going to be okay.
But, I know it was, you know. It was very tempting to skip to skip ahead, but you don't do that. So if you go out there,
the ending is triumphant and uplifting.
Yes, in its own way. But we won't tell you exactly happens.
No.
We encourage people to do it. The name of the book is Rescue. The author is Christopher Dant. You can find it on our website, veteransradio.net. Just click on the cover. It'll take you right over to Amazon, and you can get that. And Christopher, I want to thank you very much for being on the program. As I said, this was a really good book, a very good book to read, and I think there's a lot of people out there that would enjoy reading it.
Thank you.
All right. So thank you very much for being on the program, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again when your next one comes out. Let us know.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. All right. We're going to be back. We're going to be talking. Oh, excuse me. We're going to be talking with David Burnett, a crew chief on a Chinook helicopter with the 160th SOAR. I don't know if you guys know what SOAR means, but it means Special Operations Aviation Regiment. Exciting stuff. So stay tuned here to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after the news. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and my next guest is the author of a new book. It's entitled Making a Night Stalker. And I don't know if any of you know what a night stalker is, but we'll get into that in a minute. It's a member of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, or SOAR. And these are the guys, men and women, who take all the Special Forces units out to do these various missions all over the world. It's not a well-known organization, and a lot of his book was redacted, a lot of black lines in it, so it's going to be kind of fun. But their guest is David Burnett, and David takes us on, as it says here, as a reader's on a unique world of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. His journey starts in a conventional Army unit where he doesn't really feel fulfilled with his duties and obligations. His lack of responsibility drives him to pursue the dream of becoming an MH-47G Chinook helicopter crew chief in the most secretive and elite aviation unit in the world. So welcoming to Veterans Radio, the author of Making a Night Stalker, David Burnett. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Dale. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you very much. I found the book to be very interesting, to say the least. As a member of SOAR, which is a organization that was really designed for helicopter pilots and so forth, beginning back in the Vietnam era, up until today, I just found it interesting. And I'm thinking that you're probably going off to that meeting in the next couple of days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you picked up on some of the nuances and were able to relate to some of the book, well, at least the parts that weren't blacked out. And so I'm glad you could relate on some level to what I put down on paper there.
Yeah, no, the whole thing that I related to is, the main thing that I related to was being a pilot and the relationship the pilots have with the crew, not really understanding what the crew chief actually really does on a regular basis. And I don't think that probably many of our listeners know exactly what a crew chief does. And I am, that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. You were in Afghanistan in the regular army as were you a crew chief or a gunner on the Chinooks that you were flying your first time?
So my first deployment in the conventional forces, I was actually just a maintainer. So I was in a hangar 12-hour days working on Chinooks, tearing them down, building them back up after they hit a certain amount of flight hours. They would drop the Chinook into the hangar, and we would begin what's called a phase or phase maintenance, where we completely tear all the components off, inspect everything, clean everything, replace parts that need to be replaced, and then we completely put it back together, and then finish off the phase with a detailed day-long bubble bath, and the thing's almost brand new, ready to fly again.
So this is sort of like with the Hueys, we had the our 100-hour maintenance rebuilds.
Right. Same concept.
Right, okay. And so let's go back and get you into the Army in the first place. So what motivated you to join up? How did you end up in the Army to begin with?
So I was actually, right out of high school, I was going to college for aviation technology with the hopes of acquiring my private pilot's license and then moving on to commercial pilot as a career.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of my family are all fixed-wing pilots, but something about rotary wing piqued my interest more so than fixed-wing. And coincidentally, the cafeteria on our college campus housed a Army recruiting station.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I went in there and, you know, the recruiter fed me a line that I couldn't resist. And, I signed up to be a 15 uniform or a Chinook helicopter repairer, with the hopes of eventually becoming a Chinook crew chief and actually flying on the helicopter.
Okay. All right. Well, that certainly is understandable for our audience. Even if you've never been a passenger on a military helicopter, it's different than flying around in Hawaii or something like that. Let's just put it that way. All right. So you went over to Afghanistan. You were in the maintenance shed rebuilding
Yep.
Chinooks and everything. And then you decided that wasn't quite for you. So let's continue on.
Yeah, absolutely. So, being in the hangar on these long, hot days, I would often see crew chiefs out on the flight line starting up these giant helicopters. And I was fascinated by the role. And I said to myself, you know, whatever I have to do, I want to do that. And so I asked some senior leadership how I go about doing that. And the unfortunate answer I received was that there's no crew chief slots in that current unit that I was in. And I come to find out the only way I could progress and hopefully become a crew chief on a Chinook was to apply for 160th SOAR, or the Special Operations mm-hmm. Aviation Regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, I began a lengthy application packet. We had about 3 months left in Afghanistan. I started my packet. I turned it in. And about a month later, I found out I got accepted to try out for 160th as soon as we got back to the States.
Oh, okay. And sometimes in the normal workings of the military, that your paperwork got lost the first time, or it was somebody deep sixed
yep.
it on you.
Yep, absolutely. It actually happened to me twice, and my fearless leader, who was my superior, I think it was a combination of he didn't want to lose me, and he didn't want me to go into this unit, because coincidentally, he got kicked out of that unit.
Oh, okay.
He fed all the guys a line about why he got kicked out, but later I come to find out the actual reason he got kicked out when I get into the unit. So it was kind of funny to actually find out what kind of guy he was from
mm-hmm.
guys in the unit once I actually got there. But eventually, after him quote unquote losing my application twice, I finally jump over his head and jump over the chain of command and go directly to the first sergeant, turn in my application, and you know, a few weeks later it gets accepted.
I bet that was a great day for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was elated, and I found out that once we returned to the States, I would start Green Platoon or 160th selection process
mm-hmm.
two weeks after getting back from Afghanistan.
Oh, wow. So we're talking with Dave Burnett here. He's the author of a book entitled Making a Night Stalker, which is a call sign. Is it the call sign for the 160th, or is it just your nickname?
It's just a nickname given to us primarily just because all of our operations take place at night and under night vision goggles.
Okay, we didn't have those. We did a lot of things that we did a lot of things at night, which I think I mentioned to you. It seemed like we would always drop these special forces guys or LERP teams out there in the daytime, and they would run into trouble at night, and then we'd have to go out and get them and find them. And we didn't have lasers and things like I was reading in your book to mark LZs.
Right.
So it got a little bit scary. But
that's a whole different skill set that you guys had to fly unaided at night. You know, I commend that for sure.
I think I didn't even realize how crazy we were. To our audience, as I mentioned, we were talking with Dave Burnett. If you want to ask him a question. I'm always fascinated by Chinooks. I don't know. I've always been fascinated by them. These are the twin rotor blade helicopters that you see out there that are huge. You can give us a call here at 734-822-1600. All right, so let's kind of go through your training. This was the stuff that I found really interesting to me, how intense it was and the variety of trainings that you had to go through.
Yeah, absolutely. So once we got back from my first 13-month tour in Bagram, Afghanistan, 2 weeks later I start a 160th selection process known as Green Platoon. It's a 5-week selection process that we started out with 86 enlisted guys, and it's a physically demanding, mentally challenging, just barrage of all kinds of impossible tasks that the instructors essentially want to drive home, that for you to stop thinking as an individual and start thinking as a team.
Mm-hmm.
So through the 5 weeks, we kind of learn how to stop thinking about, you know, what we need to accomplish the mission, but rather what the whole team needs to do to accomplish a mission. And we go through in-depth land navigation skills, combatives training, hand-to-hand combat, intense physical training, a 4-mile, 6-mile, and 12-mile ruck marches that all have to be completed within an allotted time frame.
Ooh.
And at the end of it, we graduated about half of the 86 that we started with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no walk in the park by any means, and a lot of people don't make it through that initial 5-week selection process.
Well, as you said, you're trying to weed out people, and I was tired reading it. Oh, these, you know, 6-12-mile ruck things and all of the, you know, the hand-to-hand combat was a little bit different than it was. These are actual people trying to beat you up, it seemed like, on a fairly regular basis. All right, so we made it through the green training.
Mm-hmm.
Yay, good for you.
Yeah, finally. And then after I get through that process, I'm handed my maroon beret for graduation about 2 days prior to the class ending and graduation happening the next day, which was something I'll hold dear to my heart till the day I die, is receiving that beret. But as soon as I was handed that beret, I was told which company and which battalion I was going to go to, because I didn't, mm-hmm. I didn't know. You don't find that out to the end, because not everybody makes it through. So there's no point in giving these people orders until they finish. So handed my beret, and I'm told Alpha Company, 2nd Battalion. And mm-hmm. I didn't know much about special operations aviation past Green Platoon, so mm-hmm. I had to ask the instructor what that was and where it was. Turned out it was in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and it was a flight company. So I knew right away the only guys who make up a flight company are crew chiefs and flight engineers. So I was ecstatic to the fact that I was going to be afforded a shot to become a crew chief like I had set out to do while we were in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned in the book, one of your motivating things was you saw one of the 160th aircraft taxiing by you. It's all black and, you know, everybody's got their sun visors down and, you know, it looks, you know, like Top Gun type,
yep.
type people. And you used it as a motivation for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Big motivator. So I thought after graduating Green Platoon, I would just be I would just be a crew chief right away. But come to find out, I was very wrong, and I check in to my new company the next day after graduation, and come to find out from my platoon sergeant that I have a whole laundry list of more schooling and more training to complete before I can even deploy as a crew chief with the unit.
Oh, there was, I didn't, again, this is what I said at the beginning. I was not aware of all the training that you had to go through just to get into a helicopter.
Right. And nor was I, because when I was downrange the first time on my first deployment, a lot of the crew chiefs and door gunners in the conventional Army had to go through a 2-week-long ground school, or the door gunners on the Chinook were just pulled from different jobs around the base. So mm-hmm. a door gunner on a Chinook could be a cook or a welder.
Yeah, unfortunately, we had that. I mean, they all turned out to be great gunners, but most of them came from somewhere else. They weren't trained as for an aviation unit.
Right, and that's one of the big differences between the conventional force and a special operations aviation regiment known as 160th. Is if you're going to be a crew chief, we're going to invest all this time and energy into making you the best crew chief, because not only are the pilots counting on you, the rest of the crew, but also the guys on board who are going to go do harm to bad men in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all night stuff, therefore night stalker. Now I get it. So just kind of tick off the different types of training that you had to go through, and we'll have people read the book to try and follow you through. Some of them were pretty traumatic, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first school I had to go through was known as Dunker School, and I'm not sure as a Huey guy if you had to go through any overwater training like this.
No, they taught us to go into the water, roll to the left, and hold on,
okay.
And let it beat itself to death, and hopefully you can get out safely.
Right. Well, I guess a lot's changed since then. So I went through this school called Dunker School, and it is a 3-day-long course where you learn how to egress or escape out of a sunken helicopter. And how that training takes place is they have a giant helicopter they suspend over a humongous pool of water, and you're seat-belted into this mock trainer, and they drop it over the pool, and it begins to sink while you're strapped in. And then the aircraft starts to roll over, end over mm-hmm. end. Once it's rolled over completely, you learn how to unbuckle your seatbelt and egress out of the helicopter window that's either to your left or right, depending how you're oriented while you're underwater. You know, everything's mm-hmm. changed now. It's opposite sides. So you really have to know where your reference points are. And you learn all that in this school. And that was a really hard school for me. I just don't like being underwater, you know, in a confined space on my own breath, having to try and egress out of this thing, but managed to get through that, which was a relief for sure.
Yeah, well, yeah, we should also point out that you had to do this in the dark, and they made the pool look like a hurricane was going on.
Yep, that was definitely something to behold when they have, you know, fans strapped to the ceiling with water beaming down on you, so it feels like it's raining. All the lights are turned out. They have lightning noises going on, and they have these big fans that are blasting wind at you. And then they have a ball in the corner of the pool that pulses up and down, so the whole pool starts to become like a wave pool, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that the one thing I noticed in all your trainings that you kept going through, they kept trying to distract you from what you were doing. And I can remember them doing this, you know, to me too. But, you know, the point is that you are able to maintain your concentration and actually, you know, get out of the helicopter and all the other things that you had to do. So you went from Dunker training to what?
After Dunker training, I went through SEER school, which stands for Survive, Evade, Resist, and Escape. And it's a 3-week-long course where you learn how to be interrogated if you're ever shot down behind enemy lines, and how to kind of deter interrogation questions. You learn how to live off the land, how to trap and kill your own food, edible plants versus non-edible plants. And so it's really a intense survival course that wrapped up the end of the course, where you end up in a prison camp and you kind of put all the training you learned in the initial weeks in that final segment where really you're captured in a prison camp, and it feels real.
The way you described it, again, it's one of those things where you're going, oh my God, what are they doing to these poor guys? Because it's so realistic that as you point out in your book, that you felt like you were captured and you didn't, you know, how am I ever going to get home from this thing? I don't think it's really ever going to end.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was whole sleep deprivation and hunger deprivation thing that you just kind of have to embrace the suck while you're in the school and just try and keep telling yourself that it's just training and hopefully it will end one of the days. Mm-hmm. And finally it does end. And then I continue on with my next mm-hmm. block of training.
Well, you certainly learned how to do a lot of things, and I've got about 5 minutes left, so I don't want to run out of time here. So you go through all these various trainings that, you know, you can kind of tick off, and then they come up and say, okay, you're one of us, and guess what? You're deploying, you know, next week.
Yep, absolutely. So I after SEER school, I go to BMQ, Basic Mission Qualification course. I won't dive into that, but pretty much learn the ins and outs of how to become a crew chief and how to fly in the back of these Chinooks. So after that, then I'm told that I'm deploying in a few weeks to Kandahar, Afghanistan, to experience my first deployment with 160th. And it was the first or the second night out on mission that I get to experience what combat is really like for the first time after being in the Army for almost 2 years.
Can you describe much of our audience? There's a lot of I know a good local. A couple of helicopter pilots, crew chiefs, and so forth. And can you tell us about the weaponry that was on your particular Chinook? It's different. It's not your normal Chinook.
Right. So the Special Operations Chinook is a variation of the CH-47. Our Chinook was an MH-47. So the back two windows are cut out to make room for two 240 hotel machine guns, and then on the front two doors we have two M134 miniguns. Those are both 3,000 round a minute Gatling guns.
Wow.
So four crew chiefs versus the conventional Army has two or three mm-hmm. on board, just manning two weapon systems. We have four crew chiefs on the Special Operations variant manning four different machine guns, two on either side of the aircraft.
That's quite a bit of armor. But then you've got to, I mean, you guys are a really big target.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I can't relate to the bigness of the target, but the idea is, you know, some of these helicopters, I don't know if yours are all armored up, but I doubt if they are.
Yeah, not really much armor at all. The fuel cells have some things mm-hmm. accompanying them to try and prevent projectiles, but that can only do too much. I won't get into too much of
right.
what all is on the Chinook, just to safeguard some things. But there are definitely some things in place that would mitigate small arms fire, but not essentially stop it completely.
Mm-hmm. All right. So one of the things that you do in your unit is that you did multiple tours with the 160th, isn't that correct?
Yep, I did five deployments with 160th, and then my first deployment was a detachment of 101st was the 13-month deployment before I decided to go into 160th.
Okay, and this is hard for many people out there to understand, and I'm not trying to minimize it at all. These are not necessarily, you know, one-year tours. You didn't go over for a year and come back. They were usually 60, 90 days. What was the longest of your second group of tours?
The longest would have been 90 days. And,
okay.
Yeah, anywhere from 30 to 90 days, really.
And did you you finally decided that you wanted to get out. What made you do that?
So, I I met a girl and...
Oh, they'll do that all the time.
Yeah, the divorce rate in our company in particular was so high that I knew if I stayed in, our relationship wouldn't last. So mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to settle down, and I also knew I wanted to try and pursue something different in the civilian career space. So I just knew it was time for me to get out at the end of my initial 6-year contract.
Okay. So we're talking with Dave Burnett. His book is Making a Night Stalker. And for all of you out there that have ever been involved with aviation, or any of you that are interested in military aviation, you really need to read this. It's a great story, but it's also, it makes you aware of why today's military is so well trained, and not that we weren't trained in the past, but this is really in-depth training that makes them professional soldiers and sailors and Marines and so forth. And I would encourage people to do that. So in addition to writing, what is it that you're up to now?
So when I got out, I started inventing a clamp to be used on the very Chinook that I crewed. And so I invented this clamp over the past 4 years. I hold 3 utility patents on it. And I did a production run of 10 of these clamps and gave them to my buddies who are still in Army aviation to start testing on helicopters and different aerial platforms. And the feedback was good, but it only lasted so long because I started getting a lot of red tape from higher ups. So
yeah.
I've been focusing on a consumer version. It's going to be a Home Depot or a Lowe's clay. And the name of the clamp is Cat Clamp. So that's what I'm doing now.
Okay. Well, let us know how that goes. Again, Dave, thank you very much. Bernie, as they used to call you. I want to thank you for being on the program. Everybody has a nickname, and it's great. But I think this is a great story. So thanks very much for being on Veterans Radio. And I hope to talk to you again in the future.
All right. I appreciate it, Dale. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks, we're coming up on the end of another great program here on Veterans Radio. Next week is our benefits program. So make sure you send us your questions and give us a call during the program next week. By the way, we've got another jacket from U.S. Wings that we were going to be giving away during that program. So tune in next week. Don't miss it. Go to veteransradio.net and listen to all of our programming. Until then, you are dismissed.